sister Pamela came and said to me, there's going to be a fairy play there.
As you well know, I've been playing Jim Post for the entire show, and my next guest, Justin Peters, the author of The Idealist, fascinating, wonderful, wonderful book on every level, which I will elaborate soon, Aaron Schwartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet, comes in here and says, I met Jim. I know Jim Post. How do you know Jim Post?
I was 22 years old. I just graduated from college. I was driving around Utah with some of my friends. We pulled into Jackson, Wyoming. We hadn't showered in a week. We'd been camping out in the sort of far back country of some park out there. Looking for sustenance, I spy a guy who looks exactly like Mark Twain. Now, you know, I grew up in Chicago. You know, my parents were taking me to, Jim Post one-man shows. You know, they were old folkies when they were growing up, telling me all the stories about the Earl of Oldtown.
Sure.
So I see this guy, I put two and two together. I'm like, well, it's not Mark Twain, so it's got to be Jim Post.
It was. A smart 22-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have a 15-minute conversation with him. My friends are standing looking at me as if they have no idea what's going on while I'm talking to this
Mark Twain lookalike.
At the end, he gives me a copy of the Mark Twain of the Laughing Ripper CD, and I still have it.
That is such a great story.
It's a great CD, too.
It is a great CD. And you can imagine, you've seen Jim perform. You were younger when you did. Well, your parents have great, great taste. And you, young man, have written, is this your first book?
My first book, yeah.
The Idealist, Aaron Schwartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. If that name rings, you know, one of the sad things I'll tell you, Justin, the name rings a bell. It's a common name. I don't think people immediately associate it, even though he was from Highland Park. This started as a article for Slate magazine, for which you work.
Yeah. It was January 2013 on the crime beat for Slate at the time. And my editor calls me up. He says, do you know anything about Aaron Schwartz? And like you, and like most people, you know, I'd heard the name, but I didn't really know the story. So
right.
My editor fills me in. He says, you know, he just hanged himself. He was having some legal troubles. Why don't you go and see what you can find out?
Well, legal troubles are pretty mild.
Yeah.
He was facing, I think I'm remembering from your book here, something like a maximum sentence of 25 years or 95 years.
95 years
and a $3 million fine for basically one of the most, and I'm going to say it, one of the most innocent crimes I've ever encountered.
Yeah, it was excessive downloading. He was facing a maximum of 95 years in prison and over $3 million in fines for downloading about 4.7 million academic journal articles without explicit permission. I say without explicit permission because it wasn't as if he was obviously violating some sort of rule. He wasn't going around any paywalls or, you know, he didn't have to create some sort of ridiculous measures to get these things. It was a very sort of murky.
And even the place from which he downloaded them, and tell me I'm wrong about this, because I read the book like a week ago. They even at some point said, you know, look, we don't want to prosecute this kid. Let him go.
Yeah, he downloaded all these papers from a nonprofit online database called JSTOR. And JSTOR, conscious of its public image and recognizing that a lot of the academics who use JSTOR also knew Aaron Schwartz and were sympathetic to him, said, you know what, as long as we get our documents back, we're happy to leave it here. And they did, and they called up the U.S. attorneys and said, you know what, we don't want to see this kid go to jail, not for 95 months, let alone 95 years.
Yeah.
And they went ahead with the case anyway.
What do you think would have happened to him had he lived and gone to trial? Do you think he would have gone to trial?
I think he probably would have been found guilty, and that's not a reflection on his case. So
correct.
Much as it's a reflection on the way that our justice system is set up to find people
guilty. In this case, it was also, I think, if you could collectively say that the justice system, there's certain paranoia afoot in the case of this young man.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the sort of time when Aaron Swartz was arrested. He was arrested at the beginning of 2011. He was arrested in the basement of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology after the Secret Service and local police working together had found his laptop that had been jacked into the MIT network downloading all of these documents. At the same time they found him, WikiLeaks, the website, is making headlines. Julian Assange, its leader, is making headlines. You know, the entire world is terrified and getting, you know, progressively more so of quote-unquote hackers that are taking things they should not have and distributing them on the internet for all to see. And though Aaron Swartz's actions were categorically different than what WikiLeaks was doing, you know, to hammer everything's a nail, right? And to prosecutors whose job it is to prosecute hackers. Well, Julian Assange is in the Swedish embassy. Yeah. Can't get him, but they got this guy.
Very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Let's talk about this young man grew up here in Highland Park, right?
Yeah, he grew
up. You grew up in Highland Park, you're well-to-do.
Yeah, he grew up within walking distance of the back entrance to Ravinia Festival.
Yeah.
His family was from the area. His dad went to Highland Park High School. He had made money as an inventor. And Aaron went to North Shore Country Day. And from a very early age, he was deemed a prodigy. You know, he was very sort of adept with computers and math and technical skills to the point where by the time he entered ninth grade,
he was bored. He was sort of bored with school right? Even North Shore Country Day.
Which is a
fine private school.
Private school, and yet Aaron Swartz said, there is nothing here for me. The education system here is too structured, and it's structured in a way that is geared for people who are not as curious as I am.
Right.
So he spent his entire freshman year trying to get the school to realign itself to suit him. He would set up meetings with the principal and give the principal articles on education reform to give him ideas for how to sort of create a better curriculum. And he soon realized that the principal...
meetings were going to go nowhere. Yeah.
So he might have gotten out of study hall to take them, but that was going to be it. So at the end of that year, he basically said, I'm out. I've taken all I can from this place. I don't want to go back. And his parents basically said, okay.
And we're homeschooling you.
Yeah. So, well, he took classes at Lake Forest College.
Yeah.
And he spent the balance of his time pursuing his own education on the internet.
That's the interesting point. And the book, ladies and gentlemen, is not just the story of Aaron Swartz. Justin Peters writes, The Idealist is a provisional narrative introduction to the story of free culture in America, using Swartz's life as a lens on the rise of information sharing in the digital age. The tragic, interesting but tragic life of Aaron Swartz is what we call in the newspaper business the hook for this story. Other writers would have sensationalized this beyond all reason. Instead, Justin Peters has wrapped it into a fascinating, fascinating story of what is free, why certain things aren't free, and who began all this stuff. We'll explore this. He's going to be here till 1:45. We're going to explore this after a short break.
When we grow up, like in days of old, I'll step right.
That is Jim Post, the favorite performer of my guest Justin Peters, whose book, The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet, is not only the ultimately tragic tale of a young man who was an idealist, and is literally the... I'm sure a publisher could have come up with a, you know, more incendiary kind of title, but it's the perfect title for this. The fascinating thing about this book, Justin Peters, is it is a combination. It starts with Aaron Schwarz and then takes us back into the lives of, to my mind, equally fascinating characters. Can we talk about a few of them?
I would love it if we talk about a few of them.
So let me know when you conceptualize this, when some, I got to believe you wrote the piece for Slate, and knowing the prominence of Slate and knowing the voraciousness of New York publishers, I'm sure you got a bunch of calls saying, hey, you got, how about a book about this guy?
It was the day after. It was literally the day after the piece ran. I got the call. And it's funny, I told my wife while I was working on this story, you know, as we were at the sort of end stages of the Slate piece, I said, everything's going to change after this. You know, this isn't the end of this story. And I was right. It wasn't. But I had no idea what sort of a sweeping sort of historical narrative that the very sort of focus story I wrote for Slate would turn out to be when I expanded into a book.
Well, I think the expansion of the book is literally what makes the book. I reread the story in the magazine, and I've reread this, but the all right, Noah Webster. Everybody, see, here's a guy, almost, you know, any school kid knows that, or a school kid, when I was a school kid, knows that name. This guy is one of the great characters, real-life characters, about whom I've ever read.
He really is. He was the most insecure founding father of them all. I mean, that's saying a lot, right?
Like, yeah, it sure is.
So everyone knows Webster as the dictionary guy, right? They might not know who he is. They might think his first name is Merriam, right?
Or Daniel
or something. But before he was the man that brought the American Dictionary of the English Language to the world. He was a striver, right? He was a nobody. He was a tryhard. He was a 26-year-old school teacher who wanted to be famous, wanted to be rich, and wanted everyone to know how great he was.
He also seemed to me, from your, he also was a guy who had that element of wanting power, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This was a man who wanted to be in charge in sort of everything he did, right? I write somewhere in the book that he was born 10 years too late and 220 years too soon.
You do.
If he'd been a little bit older at the Revolution, he would have been a founding.
He would have been an outstanding framer if he'd only been old enough. But with his patriotic zeal, his rhetorical gifts, and his lifelong interest in telling his fellow citizens what was best for them, he did wind up in a terribly, terribly influential place, even though you say, and you write in the book, that his first forays into lobbying were comically inept.
So
what were those forays?
Webster, after he published his first book, which was a spelling textbook that schoolhouses across America could use to instruct American children in the proper grammar, Webster thought this book was going to be a real big hit, except the only problem was there was no copyright law. There was no national copyright law. There were no state copyright laws, which meant there was nothing stopping other publishers from taking Webster's text that he had
word for word,
and selling themselves. So what Webster did is he got on his horse, literally, and he rode from state to state to try to lobby every individual legislature.
Amazing story, I know.
And the problem, when he got started, he didn't know what he was doing, and half the legislatures were out of session, and the others, would sort of listen politely, say, "Who are you again?" and then sort of politely turn him away. But as he kept on trying, he got better at it, to the point where when he finally finished his tour in 1786, having made a circuit throughout the North and the South that included stops at George Washington's house, to George Washington's mild dismay, he was not invited, and a bunch of other eminent people. 12 of the 13 original colonies had passed their own copyright legislation, and when the federal government passed the first Federal Copyright Act in 1790, it was unequivocally Webster's doing. He was the one that brought the matter to national attention, and he deserves to be known as the father of American copyright.
Well, that's a dubious distinction, though, from what has eventually happened here. But it makes, I'm telling you, there's a portion of, God, who knows, 90 or 100 pages where Aaron Schwarz vanishes to get the context, and I think in the character of his play. He isn't in the portion of the book about Noah Webster, nor is he in the portion of the book about another fascinating guy who I never heard of, Herbert Putnam.
Putnam was the Librarian of Congress for 40 years, from 1899 to 1939. He was the son of George Putnam, who founded the great New York publishing house Putnam and Son. He was the brother of George Haven Putnam, who was responsible for many revisions in the American federal copyright law. And Herbert Putnam sort of brought librarianship into the 20th century. He was the one who turned the Library of Congress into the literally world-class institution that it is today, something that archives not just written text, but all sorts of recorded media. He was really a man of his time and a man who had his eye on the times ahead of him. And he's a forgotten American that deserves to be, you know, talked about.
No question. The guy is fascinating. Did you, Justin Peters, know much about, I mean, you must have known a little about, in dealing with Aaron Schwartz's case and problem, you must have dipped into this, but it must have also been fascinating for you to do this research.
Well, it really was. The reason why I did this research is when I started writing the book, I, you know, wrote down on a sheet of paper the questions I wanted the book to answer. And, you know, prominent on that page, you know, circled several times, were the following questions. How did we get to the point as a nation where excessive downloading is the sort of thing that could be counted as a federal crime? And academic research papers are considered private property, right? And
right.
When I started thinking about those things, you know, the more I thought about them, the more I'm like, well, gosh, to actually answer this question, I got to go back to learn, you know, where these laws came from. And, you know, the farther back I went, the more fascinated I became with.
Well, you really, your excitement and enthusiasm is palpable on the pages of this book. I mean, I sent it now in just listening to you talk about it.
Isn't that funny, though, that someone's excited over, like, the history of copyright law?
But on the face of it, it sounds deadly dull. But you have really given it astonishing life. Another guy, before we take a commercial break, Michael Hart and Project Gutenberg.
Michael Hart is from Champaign-Urbana, lived his entire life there. He was the father of the e-book. With Project Gutenberg, which still exists, you should go look it up. It's a fantastic website and resource. Hart spent 40 years of his life dedicating himself to typing public domain texts into the computer and uploading them.
Think about that, ladies and gentlemen.
He spent the entire 1980s typing up the King James Bible. It took him all of that time because it's a very long book, and he was not doing it on sort of a touch screen. These were 1980s computers that he was using. He was a monomaniac. All of these people are monomaniacs in this book.
True.
And those are some of the most fascinating people to research and write about. And those are the people that end up changing the world in ways large and small.
Did Aaron Schwartz change the world? You are, and I am too, quite sympathetic to what he was trying to do, and we'll elaborate on what he was trying to do and what his kind of cause was. He was in many ways, I fear, a kind of damaged human being. But do you find him ultimately a hero, a tragic hero, a misguided hero? There's something heroic about him. In his monomania.
I think there's always an element of the heroic when you come across real-life people who spend so much time working against their own self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go through Aaron's life story, you see that again and again. There are all of these sort of inflection points where 99% of us might have gone in the one direction that would have made us wealthy or would have made people pat us on the head and say nice things. And Aaron inevitably and always went in the other direction.
Yeah.
He made things harder for himself because he thought it would make the world a better place. And whether it did or not remains to be seen. But I think there's something, you know, undeniably heroic in making
no
that
question.
Choice.
No question. You don't overblow him. I really admire you. Certainly sympathize with his quest, let me say. But you don't overblow it, and I think that is a great credit to the book, too. We'll take a short break, get some news, and I'm going to keep this Jim Post fan here for as long as I can. We'll be right back.
There was a wedding at the Western Star Hotel. We were not invited, we were shabby genteel. We were roving around with nothing to do. So why not make a big hullabaloo? We looked for every goggle-eyed stray cat in town. Every cock-eyed hellcat hanging around.
Now, who knew that Jim Post was hugely, I'm going to say hugely influential in the life of my guest, Justin Peters. Justin saw Jim Post when he was 8. He saw him in the Utah town when he was 22, and he admires his work, and so do I. Jim plays in Galena on the weekends and does his one-man show, Mark Twain and the Laughing River. Justin Peters' book is The Idealist, Aaron Schwartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. We've been talking about some of the other fascinating characters that give the book real context and give, I think, the life of Schwartz real context, too. What is Justin Peters' free culture?
Basically, it's... I'll say what it's not first, right? So people say free culture, and they inevitably jump to the conclusion, that means that give everything away for free, that, you know, creators should not be paid for their work. And that's not what the term means at all. Think of it more as free as in liberty as opposed to free as in price, right? The free culture movement, as I sort of explored and defined it in the book, is dedicated to the very simple proposition that America as a nation is better off when its citizens have unfettered access to information that they can use to sort of improve themselves. And when you think about going back throughout history, that's been a staple American value, the notion of self-improvement, that in America there are no – it's not a caste system here. You are not
destined
to spend your life in the sort of circumstances in which you were born. If you are a poor child who is nevertheless curious and diligent, you can raise yourself out of your circumstances by careful study and application of what you've learned.
Well, it used to be you would hear stories years ago, the pre-internet stories about, you know, little boys who – I just read a book about, again, a boxer named Gene Tunney who escaped the sort of horrific family, like with an alcoholic dad who used to beat him. He escaped into words, and he eventually became not only a heavyweight champion but a scholar of such note that he would lecture on literature at Harvard. But it saved him. There was a certain – you think of it too much, not you, but people think of it too much as aspirational for money's sake. And I think the internet's had a big part in doing that too, but yeah. It always wasn't. It was just – it was too – get smarter, to learn, to improve one's own lot in life.
Herbert Putnam, who we were talking about earlier, has some great things to say about the centrality of the public library in American life and about how the public library, I can't remember the exact quote, mm-hmm. but is the sort of apotheosis of American liberty or something like that. It is where, someone who has the will to learn but does not have the means, you know, the two can come together and they can, create something, can make something of themselves. And it's not about money. And that's a very good point to make. And bringing it back to Aaron Schwartz, I was thinking about this as I was driving in here, what makes him an idealist, and why is that sort of the title of the book? What is these ideals to which he aspires? And as we were saying before the break, you know, there are so many points in his life where he had the opportunity to choose to sort of enrich himself. And when we think about the internet, right?
Give me an example.
This was in 2006. He had co-founded a website called Reddit that was purchased by Condé Nast for an undisclosed sum, somewhere between $10 and $20 million. And he was moving out to California with his co-founders to work in the offices of Wired News in San Francisco. This is right at the beginning of the sort of social media explosion.
Sure.
Literally, all he had to do was sit there and not be a jerk, right?
Not go to the head of school and start complaining.
Exactly. Not, you know, Xerox, you know, papers on how to make work, you know, more productive. And he had it made, right? You know, he had made his sort of founder's money. He would have been there to see more stock options vest. He would have been able to start other companies, been one of those serial entrepreneurs that our society, you know, venerates, you know, reflexively. And instead, what he did is on his first day at work, he got so overcome with grief at having become a cog in the machine that he went into the bathroom and he started crying. He said, "I can't take it. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be this person that I've made myself into." And he very sort of deliberately engineered his exit from the company he had just sold, which is quite a feat. You know, usually they try to keep their founders around.
Yes.
And after burning those bridges sort of behind them, he sort of spent the rest of his life really sort of spitting in their ashes and, you know, trying to build up an open internet that was, you know, dedicated toward sort of knowledge and learning instead of, you know, pursuing venture capital.
Yeah. What drove him, do you think? This is about his character, I think there remain, intriguingly to me, in reading the book, The Idealist, of a conventional but unconventional kind of childhood.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he grew up in Highland Park, you know, it's a conventional suburb, you know, and granted, the contours of his own childhood were different. You know, he didn't, like, go to homecoming or stuff like that, but this was still, you know, a place where he could walk to Lake Michigan.
Well, his house
had many stories. And I think a lot of what drove him was, I don't want to say guilt, but awareness of the comfort in which he had been raised, an awareness of the privileges that he had been given, and a simultaneous awareness that the rest of the world did not have these gifts, and that it was incumbent upon him, as one to whom so much had been given, to try to share what he had and what he had access to with those who did not.
I think the sort of misunderstood aspect of Aaron Schwartz's life is that he wasn't trying, to my mind, to steal anything from anybody. He wasn't trying to make, except even the, but the copyright laws, I think, are so encumbering. Is that a right?
It's a very good word for it.
Yeah, yeah. Explain.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? We think of the written word once it is published as this sort of undifferentiated mass, right? With nothing sort of separating a mass market mystery novel from the day's newspaper, from a sort of arcane academic article. And what Aaron Schwartz tried to liberate, quote unquote, were about 4.7 million academic articles. Now, the interesting thing about academic publishing that, you know, differentiates it from commercial trade publishing is that the authors of academic articles have no expectation of profiting from their work.
No question.
Right? You know, they are not writing for profit. They are scholars who are writing to augment the common store
exactly,
of knowledge.
Exactly. You've hit exactly on it. Yes. No one's trying to steal, you know, the Ernest Hemingway copyright, whoever owns that now. And one of the great things about copyright, you think, well, the heirs can hold this. I mean, they can be held for a long time now. It's like 95 years or something. Yeah. Which doesn't, unless the author is, you know, Eudora Welty or somebody, it doesn't really help them. But these are articles that no one had any expectation of making money on. These were articles he wanted to share, these articles, academic articles that could help make people, in short, smarter.
Well, exactly. And, you know, he had downloaded all of these articles. It should be said, he never sort of publicly declared what he wanted to do with them. That is one of the sort of unsolved mysteries that's probably not actually a mystery, right? We can speculate on what he was going to do with them. And what we know is that sort of the academic publishing houses that hold the copyrights of these articles that indeed insist on being signed over the copyrights of these articles as a condition for their publication make a lot of money. Reed Elsevier earned $9 billion in revenue last year. That's a lot of money in media for any publishing company.
That is a lot of money.
Right?
Yeah.
What they sort of claimed and, you know, have continued to claim with sort of copycat cases out there is that this sort of unauthorized download sort of imperils their business model, which I find completely tendentious.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to keep you all the way till 11 because there are no cars on the road. You can get home easily. We'll talk a little bit more about the book, which is just fascinating on so many levels. If you think Aaron Swartz is a interesting character, there are about a dozen equally fascinating characters in this book, and that's what I think makes it really something. It is no kind of salacious tabloid story of a kid's life, a flawed, I think, kid, and even sadder that he was thinking of getting married, and you know, when he decided to hang himself. We'll be back in a couple minutes and continue on talking with Justin Peters, who spends his summers in Chicago for a very specific reason.
Steamboat's coming, steamboat's coming, steamboat's coming.
That's the last you'll hear of Jim Post, the performer both. My guest Justin Peters and I have a great and grand and long affection for. Justin is the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. If you've been listening to it for the last 45 minutes and you haven't bought it already, I think you're crazy because it's a fascinating book about a lot of things, including sort of courageous, maybe misguided, maybe flawed young man who met a tragic end. But it's so much more than that. You live in New York and you spend some time in Boston and you spend your summers here. Why is that?
I'm the only guy I know who's never quit the summer job that he had in high school, because the summer job I had in high school is the greatest job that anyone can have. I'm a beer vendor at Wrigley Field.
Did you hear that, everybody?
Man,
people are going, oh, man, I should do that. How did you get a job vending beer as a teenager?
You don't start out at beer, and especially not if you're a teenager. I sort of worked my way up the ladder, right? I started with cotton candy, worked my way up to peanuts, then pop, then hot dogs, then water. And finally, when I turned 21, they put me on Old Style. And the first beer I poured, I feel so bad for the person who paid me $5. It was only $5 at the time because it was 75% head.
You've gotten better, I assume.
I've gotten
over
better.
The
it's
years.
Only 45% head these days.
This must be an extraordinary summer for you.
Let me tell you, it feels so good for the Cubs to be good. Again, not just as a lifelong Cubs fan, you know, which I am, but a working man at the park, it makes a big difference to have people actually in the park every single day and not just on Cardinals weekends.
Yeah.
People are there and they're excited, and they're transmitting their excitement to us.
Are they transmitting their excitement to you financially? Because I would think there has got to be, especially with some of the late-inning Cubs victory, there's going to be a certain, even though you can't sell beer that late, a certain euphoria that sweeps around the park.
Well, you know what's interesting, Rick? When the Cubs are doing really, really, really well, and when there are certain innings, when they're on a run, beer sales go to a standstill because no one is looking at the vendors. Everyone is looking at the field.
Interesting. Yeah.
So there'll be sort of happening stretches where I'll be walking around and selling nothing. I'll be thinking, gee, it went dead suddenly. And then I'll look at the scoreboard and I'll say, oh, they put up four runs. That's why. They'll be back at the bottom half of the inning.
How many beers do you sell on a typical nice, let's say, 82-degree day?
Oh, gosh, you dream on those 82-degree days. Well, it's 24 beers in a case. And
you carry a case.
You carry a case. Sometimes you can do doubles if I'm feeling really
strong.
Really strong. Not as strong as I used to be. I'll probably do between 10 and 14 cases on a really nice day.
Wow. And the other, you've been there for a great length of time since you were in high school.
I've been there since 17 years, yeah.
Some of the other, I've known vendors over the years, a lot of them have long tenure. Or do many of them just flit in for a summer job? It must be such a hard job to get.
I mean, I'm still a novice there. You know, I'm my sort of tenure there and 17 years. There are guys who've been working there since the 50s.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally true. Like, this is one of those jobs you get it, and unless you go to prison or something, right, you never give it up.
You die or go to prison.
And then presumably you'll get out of prison, so you'll keep up your union dues while you're on the inside.
What union are you in?
SEIU Local 1.
Are you? Good for you. How'd you get the job in the first place?
You know, it was lucky. I was sort of, I think I just showed up. You know, I showed up and I signed up and they, you know, let you sort of provisionally work for a month and then they give you the ultimatum. You have to join the union. And at that point, I was just about to go back to college. And I remember telling myself, is this worth it? You know, am I going to be back here next summer? But I put down the $140 and it was the best sort of money I've ever spent.
Where'd you go to college?
Cornell.
To study, what'd you study?
I studied American history. I studied, I wrote my senior thesis on travelers' narratives in 1820s America, British people that had come over here. And, you know, and then they go back to Britain and sort of write these very sort of catty, you know, books about how primitive like America was. Actually, one of the guys I write about in this book, Captain Marryat.
Oh, God, yeah.
I wrote about him in my senior thesis. His book, you know, Diary in America, all about how much he hated his trip to America. What I didn't realize until I read this, like, book, the whole reason he came to America was to try to secure copyright on his the books he had written overseas. And it was very funny. He tried to register for American citizenship on the claim that, you know, well, he was here in sort of America and he wanted to make a go of it. But then he was going around giving all these pro-British speeches, like, everywhere he, like, went and, like, giving toasts to, you know, the brave, you know, British heroes of the War of 1812. And he was just completely inept and he was burned in effigy several times, and then he went back to Britain and died.
Interesting. How did you fall into journalism? Or did you dive in?
You know, I'm not really suited for anything else. I've got an authority sort of problem. I'm sort of lazy. I like poking my nose into other people's business.
That's great.
You know, I'm not really suited for wearing suits and ties.
Did you ever think in your hopeful way or optimistic way that you might serve beer at a Chicago Cubs World Series? Because it's been a number of years, as you well know.
I remember 2003. I remember getting myself all
excited. You there for
that
Bartman
game? Yeah, I was there for the Bartman game. So after that, I've learned not to look forward to anything. I will say, if we do make it that far, you can find me in the left field grandstand, the 200 sections. Tell me you heard me on the radio, and I'll pour your beer extra.
You must have some regular customers. They know you're an author, too.
You know, No. The funny thing about the job is, like, there's people from all walks of life.
Yeah, you're right.
There's this guy who's a professor at some college in Missouri who just published a book of fiction recently. There are at least two PhDs in the job. There's attorneys. There's a bunch of people, a lot of teachers who just do it as like summer jobs. But no, none of my regulars know me as the author of The Idealist, Darren Swartz, and the Rise of Free
soon.
Culture on the Internet.
Yeah, believe me, they will. They will soon. Just for a couple of minutes, Justin, back to the book. It's gotten some great reviews. There are others who have reviewed it who for some mystifying reason, wanted more of the sort of, you know, what kind of rope was used? You know what I mean? What I'm saying, it's a roundabout way of saying how I admire you for going about it this way. Yes, it is. There may indeed, somewhere down the line, be another long, lengthy, detailed biography of Aaron Swartz. But not everybody deserves a long, detailed biography. You put his life and his cause and his quest in perfect contest with other, some like-minded but equally fascinating, as you call them, maniacs, sort of.
And I had coffee with Aaron's mother in December, right before the book was about to come out. I had mailed them a copy of The Galley, or emailed them a copy of The Galley, and then I hadn't heard anything
That's
from
nice
them.
Of you, though, to do.
Well,
I know.
Didn't want it to hit them by surprise.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, they probably didn't like it. And his mom sort of emails me, says, can we get together? And she said, you know, when we're sitting our lattes there, she says, you know, I think Aaron would have liked the book. I think he would have liked it that you did it this way.
That is as good a review as you could possibly have, don't you think?
Yeah.
Don't you think? I think it was complicated guy, but I think you really did do him justice, and you did the whole cause of free culture and words justice too. And I'm sure you pour really, really good beer these days. Do you?
I can do a double pour.
Can you really?
Two beers at one time. It's sort of my it's,
it's your hallmark.
It's my hallmark, yeah.
Justin Peters, the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. It is his first book, and I guarantee you it is the first of what should be many books. All he needs, you know, if it come, you know, there's a great My Life as a Beer Vendor. It's not a bad title for a book. Justin, we met just in passing, but it's great to get to know you.
Thanks for having me.
It really is, and I'll be in touch.
All right,
no question. We got to take a little break, then sign off this edition of After Hours.